Disc 12.
So for the first time in their army careers, the officers and men became seriously concerned with medals. A bronze star was worth 5 points. Inevitably, the army's hierarchical and bureaucratic systems played favorites. Lieutenant Foley recalled the regimental adjutant who picked up a bronze star for, according to rumor, selecting the hotel Zell for Sink's HQ. The men of Easy felt cheated in another way. In the paratroopers, it had been damn near impossible to win a medal other than the Purple Heart. In the 101st, for example, Webster wrote, only two men had been awarded the Medal of Honor, a private and a lieutenant colonel from the 502nd. They had both been killed in action. Major Winters, who had acquired it legitimately in a fracas with a German battery in Normandy, wore the only Distinguished Service Cross in the 2nd Battalion. In E Company, Captain Spears and two or three others had 100-proof silver stars, and about 12 men displayed bronze stars. Of Purple Hearts, there were a plenty, but that was not a decoration, but a badge of office, infantry. Most of the men in E Company had, for decorations, only the 4 battle stars on their ETO ribbon, no more than a personnel clerk who had never left base camp. There was McClung, for instance, Webster complained. He was quiet, lanky, and unimpressive, and nobody noticed him. But his buddies in the 3rd Platoon swore that old One Lung had killed more Germans than any other man in the battalion. McClung could smell kraut. He hunted them. He pursued them in dawn attacks and on night patrols. He went out of his way to kill them, took more chances, and volunteered for more dangerous jobs than any other man in E Company. McClung had made every day of Normandy, Holland, and Bastogne. And what did he have to show for it? An ETO ribbon and 4 battle stars. Sergeant Shifty Powers was in the same category. As good a soldier as there was in the 101st, he had no medals, no Purple Heart, so not enough points. But the grumbling had grown to such proportions that General Taylor decided to have a drawing in each company. The winner would be rotated home. Powers did not want to attend the drawing. "Hell, Paul," he told Sergeant Rogers, "I've never won anything in my life." But Rogers persuaded him to go, and he won. Immediately, another soldier offered Powers $1,000 for that trip home. Powers recalled, "I thought about that for a while. $1,000 was a lot of money. But finally I said, no, I think I'll just go home." Powers gathered up his loot, mainly pistols, got his paperwork done, drew his back pay, and joined the 10 other lucky men for a ride to Munich. Going around a curve, a GI truck hit their truck head-on. Powers flew out and over the top of the truck, hit the pavement, broke some bones, and got a bad concussion. Another one of the lucky soldiers was killed. Powers went to a hospital where he lost all his back pay and souvenirs to thieves. He eventually got home via a hospital ship months after the comrades he had left behind. Adding to the frustration of seeing cooks and clerks get the same points as frontline infantry was the haphazard record-keeping. All the men spent hours totaling up their points, but the trick was to convince the regimental adjutant's office. Webster was sure he had 87 points, but his records indicated he had fewer than 80. General Taylor tried to help his veterans. He decreed that every man who had taken part in Normandy, Holland, and Belgium, or who had made 2 of those campaigns and missed a 3rd because of wounds, would receive a bronze star. This was widely appreciated, of course, but temporarily caused more frustration because it took weeks after Taylor's announcement before the medal and citation, and with them the all-important 5 points, actually came through. All this chicken stuff created intense dissatisfaction with the army and its ways. Recruiters were circulating among the officers and men, trying to persuade them to join the regular army. Almost none did. Webster articulated the feeling of most of his fellow soldiers. "I hate this army with a vehemence so deep and undying, I'll never speak good of it as long as I live," he wrote his parents. "I consider my time spent in the army as 90% wasted." The only thing that he would concede was, "I did learn how to get along with people." When Sink offered Winters a regular commission, Winters thought about it for a moment or two, and then said he would rather not. Adding to the problems of frustration and anger caused by the point system was the combination of too much liquor, too many pistols, and too many captured vehicles. Road accidents were almost as dangerous to the 101st in Austria as the German army had been in Belgium. In the first 3 weeks in Austria, there were 70 wrecks, more in the 6 weeks of June and July. 20 men were killed, nearly 100 injured. One night, Sergeant Robert Marsh was driving Private John Janovec back from a roadblock by a side road. Janovec was leaning on the unreliable door of a German truck. They hit a log. He lost his balance, fell, and hit his head on the pavement. Marsh rushed him to the regimental aid station in Zell am See, but he died on the way of a fractured skull. Captain Spears gathered up his few personal possessions, a watch, his wings, his wallet, and his parachute scarf, and mailed them to Janovic's parents. He had come a long way, Webster wrote. He had jumped in Holland and fought in Bastogne. He hated the army, and now when the war is over and the golden prospect of home was in sight, he had died. Marsh had not been drinking. Easy Company was proud of its record with regard to mounting guard duty or manning roadblocks with sober, responsible soldiers and in not driving drunk. Others were not so careful. Private O'Keefe recalled the night he was at a roadblock with Private Lloyd Gee, halfway between Zalfelden and Zell am See. An open German staff car came barreling down the road, not prepared to stop. Gee and I jumped out in front of it and made them stop. There were two men dressed in German uniforms, both drunk. "What the hell you stopping us for? We're on your side." They were a couple of our paratroopers, but from some other company. We told them, "Damn it, you could have got your heads blown off." They finally promised to slow down on the driving. We told them the next guard post was about 10 miles up the road, to keep an eye out for it and to slow down to a crawl. They promised to take it easy. But when we got back, we learned that those two damn fools had barreled right through Welling's post with Welling out yelling, "Halt, halt!" After the third halt, Welling took one shot and hit the driver. Later, Welling visited the wounded man in the hospital. He said he had no hard feelings toward Welling, that he would have done the same thing. Sergeant Chuck Grant, an original Tocoa man, was a smiling, athletic, fair-haired Californian who was universally respected. He had knocked out an 88 in Holland and liked. One night he was driving a couple of privates to a roadblock for a changing of the guard. As they arrived, he saw a commotion. A drunken GI was standing with a pistol in his hand, two dead Germans at his feet. He had stopped them in their vehicle and demanded gasoline, as he was out. But he had no German, they had no English. He concluded they were resisting and shot them. A British major from military intelligence happened to have been driving by. He and his sergeant got out of their jeep to see what was going on. The drunken GI pointed his pistol at them and told them to back off. At that moment, Grant came driving past. The drunk took a shot at him but missed. The major made a move to disarm the man. The GI turned on him and shot him dead, then his sergeant. Grant came running over. The drunk shot him in the brain, then ran off. Spears thought the world of Grant. When he heard of the shooting, he and Lieutenant Foley jumped in a jeep, drove to the site, got Grant on a stretcher, and roared off for the regimental aid station. The doctor there was a disgrace, unshaven, unkempt, wearing a badly stained shirt. He took a quick look at Grant and said there was no hope. "Bullshit," said Spears, who put Grant back on the stretcher and roared off again, this time for Zalfelden. Spears had heard there were some German specialists there. One of them was a brain specialist from Berlin. He operated immediately and saved Grant's life. Word of the shooting flashed through the billets. E Company went out en masse to find the culprit. He was found trying to rape an Austrian girl in Zell am See. He was a recent replacement in Company I. To the expressed disgust of many of the men, he was brought back to Company HQ alive. He almost wished he hadn't been. Half the company was milling around him, threatening, kicking, swearing vengeance. Before anything more serious happened, Captain Spears came rushing in straight from the hospital. "Where's the weapon?" Spears shouted at the prisoner.
"What weapon?"
Spears pulled his pistol, reversed his grip to hold it by the barrel, and hit the man right in the temple with the butt. He started screaming, "When you talk to an officer, you say, sir," and hit him again. The GI slumped into a chair, stunned. Private Hack Hansen from Grant's 2nd Platoon and close buddy came running in. He whipped out his pistol. "You son of a bitch," he cursed. "I've killed better men than you." He put the pistol right in the man's face. Four men grabbed Hansen from behind and tried to pull him away, shouting that death was too good for such a coward, but he pulled the trigger. The pistol misfired. "You ought to have seen the look of that guy," Gordon Carson remarked. They beat him unconscious, then carried him to the regimental guardhouse and turned him over to the provost sergeant. When he revived, the provost sergeant beat him until the blood ran. Sink came to Company HQ. He strode in and asked Sergeant Carson, "Where's Spears?"
"Up on the second floor, sir."
Sink went up and got the facts from Spears. It took the better part of an hour. Sink left and Spears came down.
"How'd it go?" Carson asked.
"Pretty rough."
"Well, what did he say?"
"He said I should have shot the son of a bitch."
That he did not is remarkable.
One explanation I got from a number of men was that Spears must have had some doubt that the arrested man was the right man. When I asked Spears about this, he replied, "As to the Sergeant Grant shooting, you have it right. There must have been doubt in my mind because summary action never troubled me." But I wonder if there was not another factor at work. Spears was not the only man who had a chance to shoot the coward. Grant had an opportunity in the initial encounter. The man who found the I Company drunk could have shot him on the spot, and nearly every man in the company interviewed by me said he wished it had been done. Many of them were at Company HQ when he was brought in, wearing pistols, but only one of them actually tried to kill the man, and he was being held back by four others. Almost every man in that room had killed. Their blood was up, their anger was deep and cold. But what stands out in the incident is not the pistol whippings and beatings, but the restraint. They had had enough of killing. Shortly after the incident, Captain Spears wrote a long letter to Sergeant Forrest Guth, who was in hospital in England, and who had written Spears expressing a fear that he would be transferred to another division. Spears liked Guth, thought he was a good soldier, and was appreciative of his ability to keep all his weapons in prime condition. He especially appreciated the way Guth could take a file and work on the tripper housing of an M1 and make it fully automatic. Winters got one of those Guth specials. He kept it, and when he set off for the Korean War, took it with him. Unfortunately, Guth cannot remember today how he did it. In his reply, Spears expressed another side of himself. It was a long, chatty letter about the doings of E Company since Guth went to the hospital, full of the kind of information Guth most wanted to hear. Lutz fell off a motorcycle and hurt his arm. Not seriously, though. Sergeant Talbert didn't like being first sergeant, so I gave him the 2nd Platoon. And Sergeant Lynch, 2nd Platoon, is first sergeant now. Sergeant Alley got drunk again and we had to bust him. Lieutenant Lipton is on furlough in Scotland and is very happy. I'm sweating out a furlough to England to see my wife and baby. Sergeant Powers was on his way home and the truck overturned and he fractured his skull and he is hospitalized. Sergeant Stroll, 3rd Platoon, is on his way home to the States. Chuck Grant got in the way of a bullet from a drunk American and his head is not too good. He is in a German hospital near here and is getting better. Sergeant Malarkey just came back from a long stretch in the hospital. Sergeant Reinhardt just came from the Riviera. McGrath won't take a furlough. He is saving his money. Spears gave Guth the details on the Bronze Star he was entitled to for participation in Normandy, Holland, and Belgium, and promised to inform him as soon as it came through. He added a postscript. Clark is armorer artificer just now, sent Burlingame back to his platoon. He couldn't keep your kraut generator going. We have regular electricity and hot water here in Austria. By the way, you can wear your presidential unit citation ribbon and an oak leaf cluster on it no matter what outfit you're in. You earned it
with the 101st AB. The company was breaking up. General Taylor ordered all High Point men who had not yet been rotated home to be transferred to the 501 stationed in Berchtesgaden. The 501st was being inactivated and was to serve as a vehicle to transport all High Point men from the division back to the United States for discharge. Others from the old company were in hospital or already discharged. Recruits who had joined up at Mourmelon or Haguenau were now regarded as veterans. General Taylor made a trip to the States. When he returned toward the end of June, he announced that the 101st was to be redeployed to the Pacific after a winter furlough in the States. Meanwhile, the War Department insisted that the division undergo a full training regime, a critical process if it was to go into combat again, as more than three-quarters of the division was made up of recruits. So close-order drill and calisthenics became the order of the day again, along with nomenclature of the M1, nomenclature and functioning of the BAR, and nomenclature and functioning of the carbine. A road march, arm and hand signals, squad tactics, barracks inspection, mess kit inspection, military courtesy and discipline, first aid and sanitation, clothing check, map reading, dry run with the rifle, one solid week of triangulation, firing on the range. Thus it went, Webster wrote, and I with it in mounting disgust. Lieutenant Peacock returned, more chicken shit than ever. We suffered his excesses of training to such a degree, Webster wrote, that the men who had known him in Holland and Bastogne hated even to look at him. I was so mad and exasperated that if I had possessed fewer than 85 points, I would have volunteered to go straight to Japan and fight rather than put up with another day's basic under Peacock. By the middle of July, every veteran of Normandy was gone, except the long-suffering Webster, who still could not get the adjutant to accept his point total. Colonel Sink had given the High Point men a farewell speech. "It is with mingled feelings that your regimental commander observes the departure of you fine officers and men. He is happy for each of you. You have worked and fought and won the right to return to your homes and to your friends. I am sorry to see you go, because you are friends and comrades at arms. Most of you have caught hell at one time or another from me. I hope you considered it just hell and fair. It was never intended to be otherwise. I told you people to get those presidential citations, and you did it. It will forever be to your credit and honor. Then God speed you on your way. May the same fellow who led you by the hand in Normandy, Holland, Bastogne, and Germany look kindly upon you and guard you until the last great jump." At the end of July, the division was transferred by 40 and 8s to France. E Company went into barracks in Joigny, a small town south of Paris. Winters, Spears, Foley, and others took furloughs in England. On August 6th, the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, laying to rest the fears of another campaign in the Pacific. After that, everything in the airborne was in flux, with Low Point men being transferred into the 17th Airborne, others into the 82nd. The 101st magazine, The Screaming Eagle, complained, "The outfit seems more like a repel-depel than a combat division." On August 11th, Colonel Sink was promoted to assistant division commander. On August 22nd, General Taylor left the 101st, or what was left of it, to become superintendent at West Point. Shortly thereafter, the 506th packed up and moved out to join the 82nd Airborne in Berlin. It was said that Colonel Sink cried when his boys marched to the Joigny Depot for shipment to the 82nd. Webster thought it fitting that he do so, as he was the heart and soul of our regiment. Writing in 1946, Webster went on, "Our beautiful dark blue silk regimental flag with Mount Currahee, the bolt of lightning, and the six parachutes embroidered on it is rolled in its case, gathering dust in the National Archives in Washington." On November 30th, 1945, the 101st was inactivated. Easy Company no longer existed. The company had been born in July 1942 at Toccoa. Its existence essentially came to an end almost exactly 3 years later in Zell am See, Austria. In those 3 years, the men had seen more, endured more, and contributed more than most men can see, endure, or contribute in a lifetime. They thought the army was boring, unfeeling, and chicken, and hated it. They found combat to be ugliness, destruction, and death, and hated it. Anything was better than the blood and carnage, the grime and filth, the impossible demands made on the body. Anything, that is, except letting down their buddies. They also found in combat the closest brotherhood they ever knew. They found selflessness. They found they could love the other guy in their foxhole more than themselves. They found that in war, men who loved life would give their lives for them. They had had three remarkable men as company commanders: Herbert Sobel, Richard Winters, and Ronald Spears. Each had made his own impact, but Winters, who had been associated with the company from day one to day 1095, had made the deepest impression. In the view of those who served in Easy Company, it was Dick Winters' company. The non-coms especially felt that way. The ones who served as corporals and sergeants in combat had been privates in Tekoa. They had spent their entire 3 years in E Company. Officers, except Winters, came and went. Many of the officers continued their association with E Company as members of the battalion or regimental staff. But only Winters and the non-coms were present and accounted for, or in hospital, every day of the company's existence. They held it together, most of all in those awful shellings in the woods of Bastogne, and at that critical moment in the attack on Foy before Spears replaced Dyke. The acknowledged leaders of the non-coms, on paper and in fact, were the first sergeants, William Evans, James Deal, Carwood Lipton, and Floyd Talbert. Sergeant Talbert was in the hospital at Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana, on September 30, 1945. He wrote a letter to Winters. He was no Webster as a writer, but he wrote from the heart and he spoke for every man who ever served in Easy Company. He said he wished they could get together to talk, as there were a lot of things he wanted to tell Winters. "The first thing I will try to explain is, Dick, you are loved and will never be forgotten by any soldier that ever served under you, or I should say with you, because that is the way you led. You are to me the greatest soldier I could ever hope to meet. A man can get something from war that is impossible to acquire any place else. It always seemed to strengthen my self-confidence or something. I don't know why I'm telling you this. You know all that. Well, I will cut this off for now. You are the best friend I ever had, and I only wish we could have been on a different basis. You were my ideal and motor in combat. The little major we both know summed you up in two words: the most brave and courageous soldier he ever knew. And I respected his judgment very much. He was a great soldier, too, and I informed him you were the greatest. Well, you know now why I would follow you into hell. When I was with you, I knew everything was absolutely under control." Winters felt as strongly about the men as they did about him. In 1991, he summed up his company's history and its meaning. "The 101st Airborne was made up of hundreds of good, solid companies. However, E Company, 506th PIR, stands out among all of them through that very special bond that brings men together. That extra special, elite, close feeling started under the stress Captain Sobel created at Camp Tekoa. Under that stress, the only way the men could survive was to bond together. Eventually, the non-coms had to bond together in a mutiny. The stress in training was followed by the stress in Normandy of drawing the key combat mission for gaining control of Utah Beach. In combat, your reward for a good job done is that you get the next tough mission. E Company kept right on getting the job done through Holland, Bastogne, Germany. The result of sharing all that stress throughout training and combat has created a bond between the men of E Company that will last forever. Chapter 19, Post-War Careers, 1945 through 1991. 48 members of Easy Company had given their lives for their country. More than 100 had been wounded, many of them severely, some twice, a few three times, one four times. Most had suffered stress, often severe. All had given what they regarded as the best years of their lives to the war. They were trained killers, accustomed to carnage and quick, violent reactions. Few of them had any college education before the war. The only skill most of them possessed was that of combat infantrymen. They came out determined to make up for lost time. They rushed to college using the GI Bill of Rights, universally praised by the veterans as the best piece of legislation the United States government ever conceived. They got married and had kids as quickly as possible. Then they set out to build a life for themselves. They were remarkably successful, primarily because of their own determination, ambition, and hard work, partly thanks to what they had taken from their Army experience that was positive. In the Army, they had learned self-confidence, self-discipline, and obedience, that they could endure more than they had ever thought possible, that they could work with other people as part of a team. They had volunteered for the paratroopers because they had wanted to be with the best and to be the best that they could be. They had succeeded. They wanted nothing less from civilian life, and there, too, they succeeded. They had a character like a rock, these members of the generation born between 1910 and 1928. They were the children of the Depression, fighters in the greatest war in history, builders of and participants in the post-war boom. They had accepted a hand up in the GI Bill, but they never took a hand out. They made their own way. A few of them became rich. A few became powerful. Almost all of them built their houses and did their jobs and raised their families and lived good lives, taking full advantage of the freedom they had helped to preserve. It seems appropriate to start with the severely wounded. Corporal Walter Gordon had been shot in the back in Bastogne and paralyzed. After 6 weeks in hospital in England, lying helplessly in his Crutchfield tongs, he began to have some feelings in his extremities. He had been helped by Dr. Stadium, who would stand at the foot of his bed and provoke him. "You're nothing but a goddamn gold brick, Gordon." Gordon would stiffen, snap back, get angry. "Because Stadium would not give up on him," Gordon says, "it never occurred to me that I could be a hopeless cripple." When the tongs came off, Stadium got him to walking, or at least shuffling. In the spring of 1945, Gordon was listed as walking wounded and sent by hospital ship back to the States, where he slowly recuperated at Lawson General Hospital in Atlanta. He was there when the war in Europe ended. He walked with pain in the back. He sat with pain in the back. He slept with it. Any physical work was far beyond his capabilities. He was obviously of no further use to the Army. By the middle of June, his father was demanding to know when he would be discharged. "I don't know," was all Gordon could reply. On June 16th, Gordon had an examination. The young doctor then told him he was being transferred to Fort Benning, listed as fit for limited duty. So far as Gordon could make out, his reason was, "Nerve wounds are slow to heal, and to discharge a veteran with my degree of disability would justify a substantial award of compensation. By retaining me for additional months, my condition would no doubt improve." Gordon called his father to give him the news. His father went into a tirade. He pointed out to me that I had been wounded twice and was now, in his words, a cripple. He felt that I had done my fair share and the time had come for me to return home. He then gave his son an order to pass along a message to the Army doctor. Gordon did as told, although with some embarrassment. He began by running on about how this was a message from his father and that he disavowed any connection with it. "Get on with it," the doctor barked, indicating how busy he was. "My father says to tell you that if I am sent to any location other than home, he will come fetch me and fly me to Washington, D.C., and if necessary, strip me to the waist on the floor of the Senate." The doc's face fell. Gordon thought it read, "Oh, my God, that's all I need is a Mississippi senator on my case. That's a ticket to the Pacific. Get him out of here." Aloud, he said, "Okay, immediate discharge with full disability." He saw to it that Gordon got a new uniform, took him to the dentist to have his teeth filled, and got him paid off. Gordon went to law school at Cumberland University, Lebanon, Tennessee. With his 100% disability bringing in $200 a month, plus his GI Bill benefits, I was a rich student. A good one, too. He passed the Mississippi bar even before finishing his law degree. So I was a licensed attorney, still going to school. After graduation, he worked for several major companies in the oil business in South Louisiana. In 1951, he met Betty Ludeau in Acapulco, Mexico, on a vacation. They married a year later, moved to Lafayette, Louisiana, and began what became a family of five children, four of them girls. I realized that I did not have sufficient salary to support Betty in the manner in which she required, Gordon relates, so I became an independent. He went into a high-risk business, buying and selling oil leases, speculating on futures. He was successful at it. The Gordons today have a home in Lafayette and apartments in Pass Christian, Mississippi, New Orleans, and Acapulco. He still has pain, walks with some difficulty. But the Gordons are blessed with wonderful children and grandchildren. They are still in love. They love to tell jokes on themselves. It's been a good life. "And so what did the Army mean to you?" I asked at the end of our 3 days of interviewing. "The most significant 3 years of my life," Gordon replied. "It had the most awesome effect. I developed friendships which, to this day, are the most significant that I have. I'm most incredibly lucky that I got through it, and even more fortunate that I was with this group of outstanding men." In December 1991, Gordon saw a story in the Gulfport Sun-Herald. It related that Mayor Jan Ritsema of Eindhoven, Holland, had refused to meet General H. Norman Schwarzkopf because the commander of the UN forces in the Gulf War had too much blood on his hands. Ritsema said of Schwarzkopf, "He is the person who devised the most efficient way possible to kill as many people as possible." Gordon wrote to Mayor Ritsema, "On September 17, 1944, I participated in the large airborne operation which was conducted to liberate your country. As a member of Company E, 506th PIR, I landed near the small town of Zon. The following day, we moved south and liberated Eindhoven. While carrying out our assignment, we suffered casualties. That is war talk for bleeding. We occupied various defense positions for over 2 months. Like animals, we lived in holes, barns, and as best we could. The weather was cold and wet. In spite of the adverse conditions, we held the ground we had fought so hard to capture. The citizens of Holland at that time did not share your aversion to bloodshed when the blood being shed was that of the German occupiers of your city. How soon we forget. History has proven more than once that Holland could again be conquered if your neighbor, the Germans, are having a dull weekend and the golf links are crowded. Please don't allow your country to be swallowed up by Liechtenstein or the Vatican, as I don't plan to return. As of now, you are on your own." Sergeant Joe Toya describes his experiences. "After being hit, my fourth Purple Heart, at Bastogne, I went through a series of operations, the main operation being the amputation of my right leg above the knee. Then later I had two more operations. These were to remove shrapnel from my upper chest cavity. To remove them, the surgeon went in through my back. I was married December 15, 1945, while still in the hospital at Atlantic City. I was discharged from the Army February 8, 1946. He was given an 80% disability. Before the war, he had been a molder in a foundry, but with a wooden leg, he couldn't do the work. He found employment in a textile mill in Reading, Pennsylvania, then worked 20 years for Bethlehem Steel as a bit grinder. He has three sons and a daughter. I used to take the boys hunting, fishing, but I never carried a gun. I was worried about tripping. This artificial leg, if something stops it, you're gone, you know. So I never carried a gun. But I took them out deer hunting and fishing. Every year I went camping in Canada with them. There have been big improvements in artificial legs since 1946. Toya feels the doctors at the VA hospital have treated him well and kept him up to date with the latest equipment. He does have one complaint. He wants two legs, one slightly larger where it joins the stump. But because the doctors say one is enough, I don't dare gain or lose any weight, else the darn thing won't fit. Sergeant Bill Guarniere also lost his leg above the knee in Bastogne. After discharge in the summer of 1945, he was given an 80% disability. He married, had a child, and went to work as a printer, salesman, VA clerk, and carpenter, all with an artificial leg. There were some mix-ups in his records, which cost him money and led to much dispute with the VA. In 1967, he finally got full disability and was able to retire. He threw away his artificial leg, and for the past 24 years, he has moved on crutches. He moves faster than most younger men with two good legs. He lives in South Philly, where he grew up with his wife, Fran. They have five children. The oldest son was an airborne trooper in Vietnam. He is very active in the 101st Association and in getting E Company men together. Sergeant Chuck Grant, shot in the brain by the drunken GI in Austria after the war, had his life saved by a German doctor. He recovered slowly, although he had some difficulty in speaking and was partly paralyzed in his left arm. After his military discharge with full disability, he lived in San Francisco, where he ran a small cigar store. Over the years, he regularly attended E Company reunions and was active in the 101st Association. Mike Ranney nominated him to be the 506th representative on the board of the 101st Association. He was elected and served with great pride. He died in 1984. Lieutenant Fred Moose Heiliger, shot twice by his own man in Holland, was flown to a hospital in Glasgow, then shipped on the Queen Elizabeth to New York. Over the next 2.5 years, he was moved three more times. He underwent skin and nerve grafts before discharge in February 1947. Taking advantage of the GI Bill, he went to the University of Massachusetts, where he graduated in 1950 with a degree in ornamental horticulture. For the next 40 years, he worked for various landscape companies and on golf courses as a consultant and supplier. He has two sons and a daughter and continues his hobbies, arrowhead hunting, bird watching, and camping. Sergeant Leo Boyle was discharged on June 22, 1945, after 9 months in hospitals in Belgium, England, and the States. He was given a 30% disability. He got a job as a railroad brakeman, but his legs could not stand up to the strain. Then he worked in the post office sorting mail, but again his legs gave out. By that time, I was so ill and confused that I checked into a VA hospital. After several days, a team of three medical doctors declared that I was 50% disabled and released me with no career guidance. Boyle used his GI Bill benefits to go to the University of Oregon, where he majored in political science and earned an MA degree with honors. He went into high school teaching and eventually into working with the educationally handicapped. It was a career that was exceptionally rewarding. There is always a warm and good feeling between the handicapped and their teacher. When he retired in 1979, he was awarded the Phi Delta Kappa Service Key for Leadership and Research in Education for the Handicapped. Two other members of the company, the last first sergeant and the original company commander, were also victims of the war. Sergeant Floyd Talbert had wounds and scars which he handled without difficulty and memories which overwhelmed him. He became a drifter and a drinker. He made a living of sorts as a fisherman, hunter, trapper, and guide in Northern California. He had a series of heart attacks. Talbert was one of the few members of the company who just dropped out of sight. In 1980, Gordon enlisted the aid of his congressman and of George Lutz's son Steve to locate Talbert. Sergeant Mike Ranney joined the search, Eventually, they located him in Redding, California, and persuaded him to attend the 1981 company reunion in San Diego. Ranney passed around his address. Winters and others wrote him. In his three-page handwritten reply to Winters, Talbert reminisced about their experiences. "Do you remember the time you were leading us into Carentin? Seeing you in the middle of that road wanting to move was too much. Do you recall when we were pulling back in Holland? Lieutenant Peacock threw his carbine onto the road. He would not move. Honest to God, I told him to retrieve the carbine and move, or I would shoot him. He did as I directed. I liked him. He was a sincere and by-the-book officer, but not a soldier. As long as he let me handle the men, he and I got along all right. Dick, this can go on and on. I have never discussed these things with anyone on this earth. The things we had are damn near sacred to me." He signed off, "Your devoted soldier forever." Talbert had enclosed a recent photograph. He looked like a mountain man. In his reply, Winters told him to shave off the beard and get his hair cut if he intended to come to San Diego. He did, but he still showed up wearing tattered hunting clothes. The first morning, Gordon and Don Moon took him to a men's store and bought him new clothes. Before the year was out, he died. Gordon wrote his epitaph. "Almost all the men of Company E suffered wounds of various severity. Some of us limp, some have impaired vision or hearing, but almost without exception, we have modified our lives to accommodate the injury." Tab continued in daily conflict with a demon within his breast. He paid a dear price for his service to his country. He could not have given more without laying down his life. Dick Winters paid him an ultimate tribute. "If I had to pick just one man to be with me on a mission in combat, it would be Talbert." Captain Herbert Sobel had no physical wounds, but deep mental ones. He also disappeared from sight. He married, had two sons, got a divorce, and was estranged from his children. He worked as an accountant for an appliance company in Chicago. Major Clarence Hester was in Chicago on business one day in the early 1960s. He arranged for a lunch together. He found Sobel to be bitter toward E Company and life generally. 20 years later, Guarnieri tried to locate Sobel. He finally found his sister, who told him Sobel was in bad mental condition and that he directed his rage at the men of E Company. Guarnieri, nevertheless, paid Sobel's dues to the 101st Association, hoping to get him involved in that organization, but nothing happened. Shortly thereafter, Captain Sobel shot himself. He botched it. Eventually, he died in September 1988. His funeral was a sad affair. His ex-wife did not come to it, nor did his sons, nor did any member of E Company. Sergeant Skinny Sisk also had a hard time shaking his war memories. In July 1991, he wrote Winters to explain, "My career after the war was trying to drink away the truckload of krauts that I stopped in Holland and the diehard Nazi that I went up into the Bavarian Alps and killed. Old Mo Alley made a statement that all the killings that I did was going to jump into the bed with me one of these days, and they surely did. I had a lot of flashbacks after the war, and I started drinking. Ha ha. Then my sister's little daughter, 4 years old, came into my bedroom. I was too unbearable to the rest of the family, either hungover or drunk, and she told me that Jesus loved me, and she loved me, and if I would repent, God would forgive me for all the men I kept trying to kill all over again. That little girl got to me. I put her out of my room, told her to go to her mommy. There and then I bowed my head on my mother's old feather bed and repented, and God forgave me for the war and all the other bad things I had done down through the years. I was ordained in the latter part of 1949 into the ministry, and believe me, Dick, I haven't whipped but one man since, and he needed it. I have 4 children, 9 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. The Lord willing, and Jesus tarries, I hope to see you all at the next reunion. If not, I'll see you on the last jump. I know you won't freeze in the door. Easy Company's contribution to the nation's defense did not end with the company's demise. A number stayed in the Army. Lieutenant S.H. Matheson, an original company officer who had quickly moved up to regimental staff, became a two-star general and commander of the 101st. Bob Brewer made colonel, spending much of his time working for the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, in the Far East. Ed Shames made colonel in the reserves. Sergeant Clarence Lyle made a career out of the paratroopers. He made two combat jumps in Korea, and in 1954 was assigned to the 29th French Parachute Regiment as an advisor. The 29th was at Dien Bien Phu. Lyle got out 2 weeks before the garrison surrendered. He is one of a small number who have made four combat jumps. Surely he is unique in having been a participant in both the Battle of the Bulge and the Siege of Dien Bien Phu. Sergeant Robert Burr Smith also stayed in the paratroopers, where he got a commission and eventually became a lieutenant colonel. He commanded a Special Forces Reserve unit in San Francisco. In December 1979, he wrote to Winters, "Eventually, my reserve assignment led me to a new career with a government agency, which in turn led to 8 years in Laos as a civilian advisor to a large irregular force. I continued to jump regularly until 1974, when lack of interest drove me to hang gliding, and that has been my consuming passion ever since. For the present, I am assigned as a special assistant to the commander of Delta Force, the counter-terror task force at Fort Bragg. My specialties are, surprise, surprise, airborne operations, light weapons, and small unit operations. My office is on Buckner Road, right across the street from where we were just before leaving for England. The old buildings are exactly as you last saw them and are still in daily use. Funny thing about the modern army, Dick. I am assigned to what is reputed to be the best unit in the U.S. Army, the Delta Force, and I believe that it is. Still, on a man-for-man basis, I'd choose my wartime paratroop company any time. We had something there for 3 years that will never be equaled." He was scheduled to go on the mission to Iran to rescue the hostages in 1980. But when the CIA learned this, it forbade him to go because he knew so many secrets. "So I missed what certainly would have been the last adventure in my life," he wrote Winters. "I had lived, worked, and trained with Delta every day for nearly 2 years, Dick, and I hated to be left behind." That got Smith going on leadership. He wrote of Winters, "You were blessed, some would say rewarded, with the uniform, respect, and admiration of 120 soldiers, essentially civilians in uniform, who would have followed you to certain death. I've been a soldier most of my adult life. In that time, I've met only a handful of great soldiers, and of that handful, only half or less come from my World War II experience, and two of them come from Old Easy, you and Bill Guarnieri. The rest of us were okay, good soldiers by and large, and a few were better than average, but I know as much about grace under pressure as most men, and a lot more about it than some. You had it." In 1980, riding an experimental hang glider, Smith crashed and suffered severe injuries. In operating on his lungs, the doctors discovered a cancer. Rader, who had pulled Smith out of a flooded field on June 6, 1944, visited him in the hospital. They played a name game. One would call out the name of a Tocoa man, the other would supply a brief word portrait. Shortly thereafter, Smith died. Sergeant Amos Buck Taylor spent a quarter century with the CIA, working in the Far East Division of the Covert Operation Directorate, sometimes in Washington, often overseas. He won't say much about what he did, except that the big threat to our country in that part of the world was Communist China, and of course the USSR. That will give you some idea of the focus of my work. So much for that. When Captain Spears got back to England in the summer of 1945, he discovered that the English widow he had married and who had borne his son wasn't a widow at all. Her husband reappeared from a POW camp. She chose him over Spears, and the couple kept all the loot Spears had shipped back from Europe. He decided to stay in the army. He made a combat jump in Korea and commanded a rifle company on the line in that war. In 1956, he attended a Russian language course in Monterey, California, and then was assigned to Potsdam, East Germany, as liaison officer with the Soviet Army. In 1958, he became the American governor of Spandau Prison, Berlin, where Rudolf Hess was serving his life term. In 1962, he went to Laos with the U.S. mission to the Royal Lao Army. When old E Company men call him today and open the conversation by saying, "You won't remember me, but we were together during the war," Spears replies, "Which war?" His son Robert, born in England during the war, is an infantry major in the King's Royal Rifle Corps, the Green Jackets, and Spears' pride and joy. David Webster could not understand how anyone could stay in the Army. He wanted to be a writer. He moved to California and paid his bills with a variety of odd jobs as he wrote and submitted articles and a book on his wartime experiences. He placed many of the articles, the top being in the Saturday Evening Post, but he could not find a publisher for his book. He became a reporter, first with the Los Angeles Daily News, then with the Wall Street Journal. In 1951, he married Barbara Stessel, an artist and sister of Walter J. Stessel, Jr., who became U.S. ambassador to Poland, the Soviet Union, and West Germany. Webster had always been fascinated by sharks. Barbara writes, "The shark, for him, became a symbol of everything that is mysterious and fierce about the sea." He began gathering material for a book of his own. His research went on for years. He studied sharks firsthand, underwater, swimming among them, and caught many, fishing with a handline from his 11-foot sailing dinghy, which he named Tusitala, which means teller of tales. He wrote the book and submitted it 29 times, but could not convince a publisher that anyone wanted to read about sharks. On September 9, 1961, Webster set sail from Santa Monica with squid bait, a heavy line and hook for shark fishing. He never came back. A search the next day discovered the Tusitala awash 5 miles offshore. One oar and the tiller were missing. His body was never found. Barbara was able to get his book on sharks published, Myth and Maneater, W.W. Norton and Company, 1963. There was a British edition and a paperback edition in Australia. When Jaws was released in 1975, Dell issued a mass-market paperback. Three of the sergeants became rich men. John Martin attended Ohio State University on his GI Bill money, then returned to his railroad job. He became a supervisor, had a car, secretary, and pension building, and was making money on the side by building houses on speculation. In 1961, he gave it all up and, over the intense protest of his wife and children, then in high school, moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and started building homes. He had $8,000 in total capital, and everyone thought he was crazy. At the end of the first year, he paid more in taxes than he had ever made working for the railroad. Soon he was building apartment complexes and nursing homes. He expanded his activities into Texas and Montana. In 1970, he bought a cattle ranch in the mountains of western Montana. Today, he is a multimillionaire. He still likes to take risks, although he no longer jumps out of aeroplanes. He has resisted tempting offers to sell his business. The president of Martin Construction today is John Martin, while his wife, Patricia, is the vice president and treasurer. They are also the directors and sole stockholders. Don Moon used his GI Bill benefits to attend Grinnell College, then went into advertising. He rose rapidly. In 1973, he became the president of Ketchum, McLeod & Grove, Incorporated, a major New York advertising firm. 4 years later, at age 51, he retired, built a home in Florida, and has lived there since in some splendor. Carwood Lipton majored in engineering at Marshall College, now university, while his wife, Joanne, was bearing 3 sons. Lipton went to work for Owens, Illinois, Incorporated. He rose steadily in the firm. In 1971, he moved to London as director of manufacturing for 8 glass factories in England and Scotland. In 1974, he went to Geneva, Switzerland, in charge of operations in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. In 1975, Joanne died of a heart attack. The next year, Lipton married a widow, Marie Hope Mahoney, whose husband had been a close friend of Lipton's, just as Marie was a close friend of Joanne's. At the request of the CEO of United Glass Limited, he wrote a pamphlet, Leading People. It was a subject he knew well. Lipton retired in 1983. He writes, "Currently living in comfortable retirement in Southern Pines, North Carolina, where I had decided when we were training in Camp McCall that I would someday live. My hobbies are much travel throughout the world, golf, model engineering, woodworking, and reading." Lewis Nixon had always been rich. He took over his father's far-flung industrial and agricultural empire and ran it while traveling around the world. His chief hobby today is reading. Lieutenant Buck Compton stayed in public service jobs, so he became more famous than rich. He was a detective in the Los Angeles Police Department from 1947 to 1951, then spent 20 years as a prosecutor for the district attorney's office, eventually becoming chief deputy district attorney. In 1968, he directed the investigation of Sirhan Sirhan, then conducted the prosecution. In 1970, Governor Ronald Reagan appointed him to the California Court of Appeals as an associate justice. He and his wife Donna have 2 daughters, 1 granddaughter. His reputation is that he remains the best athlete in the company. He is said to play a mean game of golf. Sergeant Mike Ranney took a journalism degree at the University of North Dakota, then had a successful career as a reporter, newspaper editor, and public relations consultant. He and his wife Julia had 5 daughters, 7 grandsons. In 1980, he began publishing what he called the Spasmodic Newsletter of Easy Company. Some samples. March 1982. The Pennsylvania contingent got together at Dick Winter's place for a surprise party for Harry Welsh. Fenstermaker, Stroll, Guarnieri, Guth had a great time. 1980. The reunion this summer in Nashville is shaping up as one of the great turnouts in E-Company history. A partial list of the attendees, Dick Winters, Harry Welsh, Moose Heiliger, and Buck Compton from the officers, Chuck Grant, Paul Rogers, Walter Scott Gordon, Tipper, Guarnieri, Rader, Heffron, Ranney, Johnny Martin, George Lutz, Perconte, Jim Alley, and no less a personage than Burr Smith. 1983. Don Moon retired from the advertising business and now lives it up down in Florida. He and Gordon and Carwood Lipton had a reunion in New Orleans. With only a couple of exceptions, these men had no business or professional connections. None lived in the same town, few in the same state, except Pennsylvania. Yet they stayed in touch. In January 1981, Moon wrote Winters to thank him for a Christmas present and to fill him in. It was great news that Talbert was finally located. I called him immediately, and after an exchange of insults, we talked. I have always been fond of Tab. He took great care of me in the old days. On New Year's Day, at 6 o'clock a.m. my time, Tab called to wish me a good New Year. He was bombed, but coherent. He admits that he had a bottle problem, as we suspected, but was on the wagon except for special occasions. Guess New Year's Eve was one of those specials. Don Malarkey called me at 3 a.m. on New Year's Eve morning, and he too was well on his way. Ranney retired to write poetry and his memoirs. But in September 1988, he died before he could get started. Beyond Heiliger, Martin, Guarnieri, and Toya, a number of men went into some form of building, construction, or making things. Captain Clarence Hester became a roofing contractor in Sacramento, California. Sergeant Robert Popeye Wynn became a structural iron worker on buildings and bridges. Private John Plesha worked for the Washington State Highway Department. Sergeant Denver Bull Randleman was a superintendent for a heavy construction contractor in Louisiana. Sergeant Walter Hendricks spent 45 years in the polishing trade, working with granite. Sergeant Burton Pat Christensen spent 38 years with the Pacific Telephone and Telegraph Company installing new lines, eventually becoming a supervisor and teacher. Sergeant Jim Alley was a carpenter, then worked on high dam construction on the Washington State-Canada border. Eventually, he had his own construction company in California. Beyond Leo Boyle, a number of men went into teaching. After a 20-year hitch in the Army, Sergeant Leo Hashey taught water safety for the Portland, Oregon Red Cross. He became Director of Health and Safety Education. Sergeant Robert Rader taught the handicapped at Paso Robles High School in California for more than 30 years. Captain Harry Welsh got married immediately upon his return to the States, with his bride, Kitty Grogan, wearing a dress made from the reserve chute he wore on D-Day and carried with him through the rest of the war. He went to college, taught, earned an M.A., and became a high school counselor, then administrator. Sergeant Forrest Guth taught printing, woodshop, electricity, electronics, and managed the sound and staging of school productions in Norfolk, Virginia, and Wilmington, Delaware, until his retirement. Private Ralph Stafford writes, "Graduated in 1953 and started teaching sixth grade in Fort Worth. Taught for 3 years and was elementary principal for 27 years and dearly loved it. It was truly my calling. I was elected president of District 5, Texas State Teachers Association, Dallas-Fort Worth, 20,000 members. In 1950, I went bird hunting with some guys from the fire department. I shot a bird and was remorseful. As I looked down at it, the bird had done me no harm and couldn't have. I went to the truck and stayed until the others returned, never to hunt again." Sergeant Ed Tipper went to the University of Michigan for a B.A. and then to Colorado State for an M.A. He taught high school in the Denver suburbs for almost 30 years. After retirement, he writes, "I went to Costa Rica to visit one of my former students. There I met Rosie, 34 years old. After an old-time courtship of about a year, we married in the face of great opposition from most everyone I knew, Dick Winters excluded. It was hard to disagree, especially with the argument that marriage to a 61-year-old man probably meant sacrificing any hope of having a family, a major consideration for Latin women. Our daughter, Carrie, was born almost 10 months to the day after our wedding. Rosie went to medical school in Guadalajara and in 1989 got her M.D. He has recently been operated on for cancer. My wife, daughter, and I have just moved into a new house. It may seem strange for a 70-year-old to be buying a house, but our family motto is, it's never too late." Sergeant Ron Bain graduated from Western Washington College, now university, in 1950. Married that year, had 4 children, and spent 25 years as a teacher and administrator in Anchorage, Alaska. He spends his summers as a drift gillnetter chasing the elusive sockeye salmon. Ed Tipper sums it up with a question. "Is it accidental that so many ex-paratroopers from E Company became teachers? Perhaps for some men a period of violence and destruction at one time attracts them to look for something creative as a balance in another part of life. We seem also to have a disproportionate number of builders of houses and other things in the group we see at reunions." Private Bradford Freeman went back to the farm. In 1990, Winters wrote him, saying that he often came south to see Walter Gordon and would like to stop by sometime to see the Freeman's farm. Freeman replied, "It would be a great honor for you to come see us in Mississippi. We have a good shade to sit in the summer and have a good heater for winter. About all that I do is garden and cut hay for cows in summer and feed in winter, fish and hunt the rest of the time. We have the Tom Bigbee waterway close, and I watch the barges go up and down the river, sending you a picture of the house and cows. I have a good place on the front porch to sit. Here's hoping that you will come down sometime." Winters did. They had a good visit. He asked Freeman to write an account of what he did after the war for this book. Freeman concluded, What I wrote don't look like much, but I have had a real good time and wouldn't trade with no one. Major Richard Winters also wrote an account of his life after the war. On separation from the service on November 29, 1945, Lewis Nixon invited me to come to New York City and meet his parents. His father offered me a job, and I became personnel manager for the Nixon Nitration Works, Nixon, New Jersey. While working, I took advantage of the GI Bill and took courses in business and personnel management at Rutgers University. In 1950, I was promoted to general manager of Nixon Nitration Works. I married Ethel Estapi in 1948. We have two children. Tim has an MA in English from Penn State and Jill a BA from Albright College. I was recalled to the Army for the Korean War. At Fort Dix, New Jersey, I was put on the staff as regimental plans and training officer. After discharge, I returned to Pennsylvania to farm and to sell animal health products and vitamin premixes to the feed companies. In 1951, I bought a farm along the foothills of the Blue Mountain, 7 miles east of Indiantown Gap. That's where I find that peace and quiet that I promised myself on D-Day. This is typical Winter's understatement. He lives modestly on his farm and in a small townhouse in Hershey. But he is a wealthy man who achieved success by creating and marketing a new revolutionary cattle food and other animal food products. He is also the gentlest of men. In July 1990, when he finished telling me about practically wiping out an entire German rifle company on the dike in Holland on October 5, 1944, we went for a walk down to his pond. A flock of perhaps 30 Canadian geese took off. One goose stayed behind, honking plaintively at the others. Winters explained that the bird had a broken wing. I remarked that he ought to get out a rifle and shoot the goose before a fox got her. Freeze her up for Thanksgiving dinner. He gave me an astonished glance. I couldn't do that, he said, horrified at the thought. He is incapable of a violent action. He never raises his voice. He is contemptuous of exaggeration, self-puffery, or posturing. He has achieved exactly what he wanted in life, that peace and quiet he promised himself as he lay down to catch some sleep on the night of June 6 to 7, 1944, and the continuing love and respect of the men he commanded in Easy Company in World War II. In one of his last newsletters, Mike Ranney wrote, "In thinking back on the days of Easy Company, I'm treasuring my remark to a grandson who asked, 'Grandpa, were you a hero in the war?' 'No,' I answered, 'but I served in a company of heroes.'"
That was Band of Brothers by Stephen Ambrose, read by Tim Jerome. We do hope you've enjoyed listening to this Chivers audiobook. For details of further titles, please contact us at Chivers Audiobooks, Post Office Box 1450, Hampton, New Hampshire, 03843, or call us at 1-800-621-0182.